Hey everyone, something a little different today. We are putting up this week. There'll be another show probably a little later, but right now this is a show I've been doing with my buddy Josh. It's called Q for You. The premise is that we trade off weeks, asking each other questions that we have to answer. It's about episode 8 now. I'm really proud of it. Josh and I have been doing really good work with it. I think it's funny. It's a nice little kind of back and forth sort of thing for anyone who likes that that kind of like repartee and I guess parasociality. I think you'll really like it. Wanted you to get a chance to listen to it in case you didn't follow me on socials and see that I was promoting this. It's at Q4U, so that's the letter Q, word for F-U-R, the letter U, pod.com. And also, of course, on all of the various podcasts you could possibly want, there are there's a lot of books, a lot of episodes. I hope you enjoy. This one is, as you will find out, how do you hunt people?
Josh, as that was all gold, I want to continue that gold by asking you a cue. But this time you get to pick.
Oh.
You get a bit of a choice.
Choose your own cue venture.
A little bit. I had two ideas in mind. One's a little whimsical. Mm-hmm. It's a little out there. So if you're in the headspace to be a little creative and a little weird, that would be the one to pick. Or you can pick one that's a little more standard. I'm happy to do either. They're both decent questions. So answer with your heart.
I hate creativity. I think creative people should be put in the gulag. But that said, I feel like creativity is good for content. They both start with a C. So you can see that they're a perfect fit. So I choose the creative cue.
Well, this is exciting because you said everyone belongs in the gulag and you're not too far off, when I bring this to you. I'll tell you the other question was going to be, how do you start a video game? And so that'll be fun to talk about another day. But today the cue you're going to be A-ing is, if you had to hunt the most dangerous game, man, how would you do it? assuming you have unlimited resources, and you had to hunt man, how would you go about it?
You weren't exaggerating. This is easily our most creative cue yet.
It's by far our most whimsical cue. It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And side note, I can't decide yet how I feel about the verb A-ing.
Yeah, it's not great. Q-ing makes a lot of sense, but A-ing, I kind of hate.
So as I'm formulating my response, I'll talk a little bit about, I am not much of a hunter. Listeners may be shocked to know that despite my tough guy persona.
And your several endorsement deals with Realtree.com.
My dad, when I was younger, he's not anymore, but when I was younger, my dad was big on hunting.
And, oh, really? I didn't realize that. I didn't know your dad was a hunter.
Yeah, he was a big deer hunter, which, for those who aren't in our area or in, you know, a certain area of the U.S., like, deer hunting in certain areas of the U.S. is a very popular and sometimes necessary thing.
Especially Pennsylvania. They like, Southeast Pennsylvania, they will just, like, run rampant if you don't hunt them down a little bit.
Yeah, they'll essentially spill out onto the roadways and cause horrible accidents. I'm sure that Trevor and I both know so many people who have either hit a deer or come very close.
Oh, I mean, I've almost hit a deer a number of times. It's like, you know, those back roads that I take to get to my dad's house through New Jersey. I mean, if you're driving those at night, you see like at least 20 deer. And that's like a healthy population. Around like Valley Forge Park, they can get like, I've heard they can get just like truly disastrous because they just like they eat every bit of grass and destroy the whole area.
The most unsettling part is when you come upon a deer or a crowd of deer and they kind of give you like a casual look and then go back to what they were doing. Like they don't move and they're not afraid of you. And it's very ominous and unsettling.
It's like, I mean, this is another Pennsylvania thing, but it's like the squirrels at Penn State. I don't know if you ever like have heard of them or run into them. I've only run into them by reputation, but at Penn State there are these big fat, I think they're gray, but they might also be black squirrels that just like, because they live on Penn State's campus with all these people who just give them food, they're just like extremely aggressive and don't fear people at all. So they will not back off when you go after them. It's just horrible. Like, it's like you're the timid creature. You're not supposed to do this.
I've not been on the Penn State campus, but that actually sounds like there are certain Philly squirrels, especially if you go to the zoo. What they do is they kind of gather by the eating areas of the zoo, and they will. One time I went to the zoo and a squirrel came up to, he was touching like the tip of my sneaker and waiting for me to toss him like a piece of popcorn or something.
That's kind of crazy. I mean, it's like seagulls are different because seagulls are always like looking for a handout. Seagulls are the things that conservatives want you to believe that like poor people are. That's what seagulls are. They will 1,000,000% take a handout from you at all times. They don't want to work for it.
I want to dismantle the welfare state apparatus we have erected to support seagulls.
I think you know, I'm all for the welfare state supporting people, but I'm sick of this welfare state supporting seagulls. Where are my tax dollar French fries going, if not into the gullet of a seagull? But I mean, they're aggressive anyway. But yeah, it's weird when the docile animals become not docile. I mean, it's very, you know, like Alfred Hitchcock. It's like, okay, this is off-putting because like not because I really think a deer is going to hurt me, unless it's like a buck because they have those, you know, giant. But I mean, it's a big enough animal. And when it's right next to you, like there was a deer. I'm trying to think where we saw it. I can't remember where it was. It might have even been back in Illinois, but like it was walking with Tilly, and it was like 10 feet away from us. And it was one of those things where it's like, okay, this is not great, because if I make the move where the deer freaks out and runs away, that's fine. But if I make the move where the deer freaks out and runs over me and my daughter, that's bad. Like, cause they're big. They're significant creatures.
Yeah. And you can tell yourself, you know, a deer is a prey animal, and it's super unlikely that it's going to decide to take me on and become a predator animal. But also like, why take the chance that you're going to be the first guy that a deer decides to turn on?
As we saw in Evil Dead, be it mounted or alive, a deer can do some damage. It's true. Like I feel like we're also, well, I mean, I might not be speaking for the hunters. Maybe your dad had a better relationship with nature than me, but like, I feel like I'm so civilized at this point that whenever nature comes close to being nature around me, I'm just like, whoa, hold on, this is too much. Like, please, please slow down. I don't want to be in danger. I don't want to be part of this food chain. I don't care for this.
Yeah, I'm the conductor in The Simpsons in the snakes episode who is sitting on the bench, and he's like, ew, a bug. And then he gets like swamped by all the snakes fleeing from Whacking Day. That's me.
I love that conductor. They kind of run away from him a lot, I think, because they kind of realized that saxophone doesn't make much sense in an orchestra. And then they were like, well, I guess that guy's not going to be a part of it anymore.
Lisa,
he's still
do you
theme song.
Do you find something funny about the word tromboner?
Nelson likes Lisa. She does not. Milhouse likes Lisa. He does not. Lisa likes Milhouse. Nobody likes Milhouse.
Yeah, there's something. There's something. It almost feels like it's presaging the apocalypse when a prey animal does not show sufficient, you know, deference to you, an obvious predator animal. There's something very unsettling about that, because what you suspect is that very soon they're going to realize that they outweigh you by hundreds of pounds, and they could turn the tables on you with ease, and you're powerless.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's like, it's not even, it's cause I don't, you know, I'm not scared in the way that I feel like there's like a whole cottage, industry of horror movies that like rely on this, right? Where it's like, maybe this thing's going to get scared. Maybe like this thing's going to get smart and kill you. And it's always like thinly veiled vegetarian sort of like stories or stories about why you should be vegetarian. Still the most effective of those is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, still undefeated as a warning sign to become vegetarian.
The original Texas Chainsaw Massacre is just a singular experience. Like it, for any, I envy anyone who hasn't watched it yet, because it's just so it like, and even all these years later, it just is. It's amazing. It's insane.
I taught the movie one time.
No way.
Like, yeah. I TA'd a course in film. Which was fun. It was pretty interesting. The guy Marty, was the, not Marty, not,
this
not
is that Scorsese.
Marty. Yeah. Mr. Scorsese himself. Now, Trevor, I gotta get out of here to do my movie, but maybe you can teach the kids, teach them a little bit about Buster Keaton or something. Okay, Marty. All right. Well, I have the syllabus. I guess I'm teaching again, kids. Your professor has to go out and get another award. First movies that don't center women. But no, I forget his last name, although I have, but he was a really nice guy. He used to like curate films in the village in the 70s. He was a weird dude, but very, very smart, very knowledgeable. But when you TA something at UIC, where I got my PhD, a lot of times in the summer, they'll give you the opportunity to teach a version of that course, because the summer's like way lower stakes. Like no one really expects the same quality in the summer. So this is how I like solo taught a Shakespeare course, even though that's not my focus, and solo taught a film course, which is definitely not my focus. And I taught a lot of stuff in that class. I taught Drive, which was really fun. I taught Drive and I felt really bad. There was a really nice, she was like, I think she might have been a little more conservative than not, but like, or religious maybe, but she was a woman who came in, like, she was just, you know, maybe middle-aged, had kids, a really sweet woman. And she came in on the second day of Drive, which is like basically starting off with what's her name? From Mad Men. The redhead from Mad Men.
Peggy.
No, not Peggy. The other one. I'm gonna find this out. This is bothering me.
Joni.
No, well, it is Joni. Christina Hendricks. Which is like, it starts with Christina Hendricks getting her head blown off, like, and then from there on just like turns into an extremely violent film. And I was like, oh, sorry, this isn't really representative of the class as a whole. To her credit, she stuck with it.
Did you tie it back to her at the end by explaining that Gosling in that movie is a Christ figure? He's a hero and a real human being.
Well, she was Muslim, so I had to say that he was a lot like Muhammad, which I don't think went over well.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I said, did you notice how he moved the mountain to himself? And she said, that didn't happen in the movie. The mountain is Albert Brooks. But like, I also taught Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and like, you could feel how uncomfortable everyone was during that whole movie.
Just, like, I can't, I actually can't, like, kudos to you for trying that. Cause I can't imagine watching that movie with a room full of strangers, let alone like a room full of students.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, the room was dark. It was like a serious projection space too. So it was like big on the wall. The sound was really good. So
you could really hear the gristle during the dinner scene.
Yeah, the dinner scene at Odd was just like, I was like, yeah, it's pretty crazy, huh? It's like, ugh.
Yeah, speaking of gristle and being repulsed by gore.
Yeah, back to it.
Well, so my dad was a hunter. He hunted the out of control deer population to keep them from turning on us in Pennsylvania. And when I was younger, he super hoped that I would be into hunting with him. And I remember feeling like not interested in it, but also not necessarily opposed. So I went with him a time or two. I never saw him get anything. I thought it was pretty boring. And then one day I came home from school and we had a swing set in our backyard, like a small wooden swing set. And I walked into the backyard and trussed up on my swing set, my childhood swing set, was a very large deer, dripping blood onto the ground. my dad was in the process of gutting it.
Oh no. Was this your house? This wasn't your house in East Greenville, was it?
It was the East Greenville house.
Okay. I didn't remember that. Oh yeah. No, you did have a swing set in your yard. Okay. I know what you, like right by the alley.
Yes.
People walking by to see gore.
Yeah. So we did not, we lived in a row home and well, a twin, but you know, a connected house, and, our backyard was small, you know, it's like, it was so picture when I say a swing set, some people might be picturing like a, you know, a verdant, you know, acre of green, and there's a little swing set, and I kind of could just barely make out the deer. No, I entered the rear of my backyard from an alley that was maybe 15 feet away from where the swing set and bloody deer were sitting.
And I lived across the alley. Josh and I grew up pretty close to each other. The infamous alley where my sister tripped while carrying Subway, and I asked her if the Subway was okay. I've not been fully forgiven for that one. But it was. The sodas in the Subway were fine.
And Caitlin was never the same.
No, she lost both legs.
It was a hell of a trip.
But yeah, so he was gutting a deer in your tiny backyard. That's terrifying.
Yeah, and the, you know, I forget how old I was. I want to say I was either late elementary school, early middle school. So we're talking, you know, somewhere between, let's call it like 9 and 11. And, you know, even at that age, relatively young age, the symbolism of the bloody deer on my childhood swing set representing my loss of innocence in the world was not lost on me. I thought about that a lot. And my dad was, you know, he had this bloody sharp knife that he was using to skin the deer and gut the deer, because my dad, he didn't just hunt for sport. Like, we would eat the meat of the deer.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Cause it's like, none of us, I would say, like, none of us in that, like, East Greenville was kind of uniformly sort of like working class at that point. So no one was like particularly like well off. So everyone who hunted ate right. the meat too.
Right. Yeah. You got to use every part of the animal.
They were also Native Americans, all of us.
Most of our clothes in East Greenville were made out of deer skin and squirrel skin.
All the meat we ate at the cafeteria was just giant hunks of venison, bloody and raw.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up venison, because as I stood there witnessing this deer being trussed up and carved, I thought about the venison and the deer jerky that we ate.
And enjoyed so much.
And I felt like Lisa in the vegetarian episode of The Simpsons, where the deer was like, Josh, don't eat me.
Don't eat beef. Eat lamb.
Dad, those all come from the same animal. Sure, honey. One magical animal. So I thought about all the deer I had ingested, and I stared into the poor dead black eyes of that deer on my childhood swing set, and I thought, I don't know if I can eat deer anymore. And who knows about other meat? It was a real crisis of meat conscience for me in that moment.
No, you are not a vegetarian currently.
I am not a vegetarian currently. And in that moment, though I wavered, I did not become a vegetarian at age 10. However, I did become a vegetarian of not eating deer meat in that moment.
That's not the hardest thing to do in most instances. I imagine it was a little trickier in your house. I can't imagine. I like your parents a lot. I can't imagine that went over well.
It's interesting because I think you would be right if I declared it as a stance that I was now taking and kind of made it like abrasive and like, this is on principle and I'm not doing this anymore. But I had this intuition that it wouldn't go over well if I did it that way. And so, the next time we had deer for dinner, I just said I wasn't feeling well and I didn't think that I could eat it. And we had deer infrequently enough that I did it a couple times. And then I think it sort of was dawning on my mom maybe what had happened.
Okay. I mean, your mom's pretty perceptive that way.
Yeah. She didn't press me on it. And we kind of just stopped talking about it. And it coincided with my dad as the years went on, he hunted less and less and he kind of got disinterested in it. And so the problem just sort of resolved, and I didn't go back to eating deer for a really long time. I think I was in my 20s when I was at a restaurant and they had it on the menu. And I decided, like, this, maybe this is a time I either need to be all vegetarian or not. Like, this, it doesn't make any sense, like, what I'm doing. Like, I'm clearly just holding on to this because it was a traumatic memory. It's not a principled stand or anything.
Yeah, sure.
And so I took the plunge. I ordered it. I did not either throw up or have, like, a psychic break. It was fine. And so that period of my life ended, and now I am reunited with deer meat, which, to your earlier point, you don't really come across all that often.
No,
really.
I can't tell you the last time I had venison. I think probably in jerky form. Like, I think that's it. Like, it's not, it doesn't show up in restaurants either. It's not like where you're like, ooh, do I eat lamb or veal or like sweet meats? It's like, no, it's one of the lesser meats.
That was one of the reasons why I ordered it when I saw it. Cause I was like, you hardly ever see this in restaurants, and perhaps this is my chance. This is my chance sign. It's a sign from the meat god.
I'm glad you put the meat god into your life. Although I'm a little alarmed. we haven't talked about this yet, but I'm pleased, I guess. I always want to celebrate whatever anyone thinks. I hope the meat god is not as ominous as he sounds.
Friend, have you heard the good news about meat?
You heard the delicious news. Yeah, so that's interesting, because like it really was like I feel like I never went hunting, and like it wasn't. But I also never had anything against anyone who did, right? Like, especially for sport, or especially for food, or like population control or whatever. I think, you know, like most people, I have a bit of an issue when it's for sport, like hunting like a rhino or something like that, obviously. But like, you know, wolves from a helicopter or whatever, it's just like, it's kind of stupid. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, if you're hunting those giant hogs that are destroying the South, or deer or whatever, like, all right, fine. It's not really hurting anything. If you can get past the sort of like sad part of it, and most people can, but it is interesting thinking about hunting from that perspective. Cause like hunting the most dangerous game, hunting man, is such a kind of like sci-fi thriller kind of thing. And then hunting in general, I bet for a lot of people who grew up in like an urban area, is kind of like a weird thing too. Whereas like for me, I was like, and for you, I think we had the first day of hunting season off for quite a while. Maybe the whole time I was in high school, at least it was one of those days where you could just like tell the people like, hey, I'm taking off. And it was like, oh, right, that's fine.
You didn't have to hide it at all.
Yeah. It was essentially as well regarded in the late 90s and early 2000s as Yom Kippur. They shared
roughly equivalent.
Happy hunting day for those who are observant.
I mean, really, where we grew up, there were probably more people who observed the first day of hunting than Yom Kippur
by an exponential margin. A friend of ours, Kevin, recently moved from like the Perkasie area. Not that recently, but a while ago, moved because he was like. He was down here and he really enjoyed it. He liked the area, but he was like, you know, his wife is Jewish and their kids are Jewish. And he was like, yeah, I kind of thought about like the Jewish population around here, and it's actually zero.
It does not extend beyond the boundaries of my property line.
Yeah, like there's like two other Jewish people here. I was like, yeah, like you're not wrong. Like there aren't many of them. And it's weird. It is kind of what it is. But yeah, definitely more hunters.
Yeah. Yeah. Much
a lot more neo-Nazis, too. But that's sort of a different problem.
Yeah, that's a much different problem. You wish there was a way we could take the one group and use it to solve the other problem.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the Venn diagram is fairly robust. Your dad is on the outside of it, though. Your dad is not a neo-Nazi, just so everyone knows.
No. For the record, my dad never hunted the most dangerous game, Jewish or otherwise. He stuck to deer.
So if you were, though, so you have a leg up on me with this, because I never went hunting. You actually went with your dad hunting. Did you learn anything in that experience that would help you hunt man?
Well, I learned that hunting is all about being extremely bored and fighting that boredom as much as you can so that you do not miss any signs of your prey. that was my learning from hunting. And so if I were to apply that to this situation, I would say, were I to take the approach, and I'm not saying I would, but were I to take the approach of posting up in a blind somewhere and waiting for my prey to walk by, I would need to make sure that my thoughts did not drift, as they certainly would, and you know, miss my chance.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, this is you know, part of it. What's kind of interesting is once you make the question sort of banal and think about like the actual sort of structure of what you'd have to do, you start realizing like, oh, this is just like what the DC sniper did, like just like drove around like in a trunk for a while and like hung out and like peed in bottles until they got their shot.
I was thinking about in a similar vein. I was thinking about like playing Grand Theft Auto. That's another place where, you know, you can burn some time hunting the most dangerous game. I mean, much like the DC sniper, I feel like in Grand Theft Auto you can sort of post up by a highway and just, you know, start shooting gas tanks of cars that are driving by.
Yeah, correct. And like it's much more horrifying when you think about it that way than in the movie The Most Dangerous Game, where it's like, you know, you're on an island, someone offers you $1 million if you can escape them. It's like there's something very distant about that, as opposed to like, oh, you want to hunt the most dangerous game? Well, posting up on a highway has a lot of innocents who can't fight back. It's like, ugh.
I was actually gonna ask about that, like the premise of the question, because certainly the way you phrased it evokes the short story in the movie. So my question was going to be, is that the parameter in like, are those the parameters in this case?
I think so. Yeah. Cause I was actually just listening to I think it was like 48 hours or something. Cause they have them on YouTube now. So they show up in my feed. So I put it on and I get to hear the guy from 48 hours. I'm like, I know that voice, and you know, I drift away. It was about this guy who like basically he killed another guy for no reason, just like posting up next to him in traffic and like just killed him, just picked him out. And it was like,
there was no like altercation or anything.
Well, he later claimed that it was self-defense from road rage, like well after the fact, but like basically like he picked the most chill guy possible. And everyone's like, he's the nicest person in the world. Like he never had a bad thing to say about anyone. And like all the evidence showed that like, there was no like altercation. It was crazy. Thinking about that, it's like, okay, well, look, if you're hunting humans, there are people who do that, and they're serial killers or killers or whatever. That's a different question. I would never ask you if you would be a serial killer. What would you do? That's a little much. I feel like that's making you go into a pretty dark place. So let's do it like The Most Dangerous Game. If it helps you conceive of it, you don't even have to like kill the person. It could be a simple sort of like, you know, YouTube style stunt video where you're like, if you get off this island without me hitting you with a paintball, you win $1 million.
Yeah. Mr. Beast's Most Dangerous Game.
Mr. Beast's Most Dangerous Game. Declaring his profits to the IRS.
Ho ho.
You are correct.
Man, why didn't we think of before to simply just evolve the show into Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon?
All sorts of celebrities around. They're like, okay, so what is this? It's like, it's a podcast. No one's going to see you, Bradley Cooper, but I'm glad you're here. We have a cue for you.
We have a cue for you, and we'll be doing it under the guise of very poor impersonations of Johnny Carson.
Well, we got a really big shoe. A really big shoe.
Oh, yes.
So he said show. He didn't say shoe. Really big shoe. So you can imagine it that way. That probably makes it a little more palatable.
Yeah. So right. The contrivance is I have agreed to this scenario in which for $1 million, or I paid someone $1 million because I'm wealthy in order to hunt them for sport.
You can imagine you're hunting me for sport, if that helps.
Well, it's funny because if there's a specific target, then I'm trying to get inside their head. I'm trying to think of how they would behave and perhaps tailor my strategy accordingly.
Interesting. I'm going to then handicap you a little bit and say it's someone you do not know.
Okay.
It is a random person. We've chosen someone. I mean, I'll say like they're 20 to 35. We'll say it's a guy, a 20 to 35 year old guy. You can have like some sort of sense. Like you can have a gender identity with them. That's fine. And a general age identity, but that's about it. That's the only thing you know.
Okay. So I think And I believe if I'm remembering the, I've actually never seen the movie. I did read the short story. But if I'm remembering the story correctly, basically, I think it's that the person kind of gets set loose from the mansion or whatever it is. And they get like a certain amount of head start.
Correct. Yeah. Because it's like, you know, the other person has a gun. They know the island, everything like that. So, yes, they get an hour head start.
That's an important distinction, too. So I, as the hunter, I know the geography of the island, and the contestant does not.
Correct. Here we will just to be really sure. what good planning I did here. Is the most dangerous game based on a true story? Thanks, Google. Yeah, it is.
Well, we all remember that crazy time when a guy bought an island.
All right. So the story features a big game hunter from New York who falls from a yacht, swims to what seems to be an abandoned island, where he's hunted by a Russian aristocrat.
Which is me.
So, yeah, you are the Russian aristocrat. So basically, let's see. Any captives who could elude Zaroff, Ivan, and a pack of hunting dogs for 3 days are set free.
Oh, that's right. There's the dogs, too.
Yeah. So Zaroff has never lost a hunt. The captives are offered a choice between being hunted or turning over to Ivan, who basically was a whipsman for the Great White Tsar.
Now, that is a job title I would kill to have. I want to be a whipsman.
It's called a knouter, or a knout, or I guess it's a knout. Knout.
Knout.
It's a Russian whip that consists of a rawhide thong or rope attached to a long wooden handle, and someone who is a knouter uses that to punish people.
Hmm. I do like administering punishment.
You'd be great for this. This hypothetical is working out great for you, then, I think. Yeah, the basic idea of the most dangerous game is that you have someone who is at a disadvantage because they do not know your land. You have more resources, but they have the advantage of being a thinking, breathing human being. They could reason, they could do all this stuff. So what would you do to gain your advantages?
Yeah, so I think one of the most obvious advantages inherent in this scenario is that I know the land, they do not. Presumably, I know it extremely well. It's my island, I'm a Russian czar, I've spent a lot of time on there practicing my whipsmanship. I know every square foot of this island. And so I think one of the first things that I would do is I would consider, with my knowledge of the island, regions or sectors where I would think they would be likely to go. Now, at first, they would be fleeing out of sheer panic. They wouldn't be heading anywhere in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I would assume that at some point, I would wait them out a little bit, assuming that they're going to look for where's the water on the island. Is there any water? If so, and not the salt water surrounding it, but is there any place they can drink fresh water? Is there like a gully that they would think would be a good hiding spot for me?
They might look for the salt water too, because they think maybe they can swim for it, or maybe they can fashion a boat, or maybe there is a boat, right? Like, you had to get on the island somehow. It's all stuff probably go through their mind.
That's actually a really interesting strategy, would be setting out a boat ahead of time as a honeypot for them.
Oh, interesting. And would you trap the boat, or would you be waiting by the boat?
Booby trapping the boat would be easier, but perhaps not as sporting.
Mm, true.
You have to consider the sport of the matter.
So for you, the boat is like a salt lick.
Right. Yes, exactly. Now, you could poison a salt lick, but what's the fun in that? Plus, then you can't use every part of the animal.
You can't eat poisoned meat. That's not good. You're not just traumatizing your son there. You're poisoning him. And that's a no-no. You're allowed to traumatize your kids. It's important. But
it's part of growing up.
It is part of growing up. You got to see your dad do something horrible.
Yeah. I mean, really, this whole podcast is an extended thank you to my dad for that, too, because I lost my childhood innocence in such a pronounced and symbolic way that a lot of other people would kill for.
A lot of people have to deal with the fact that they lost their childhood innocence being hunted on a giant island by a Russian czar.
Right. Yeah.
Not good.
Tell you what, you're not coming back from that the way you are seeing your deer on your swing set. All that did was make me not eat meat for a little
and
while.
And not want to go on your swing set for a bit. That's a good idea. Here's a question about this. Would you string it along? Would you decide, would you like, you know, would you play with the person and try and like trick them or like, you know, watch them suffer or whatever? Or would you simply do this to be most efficient?
I think I'd be looking for efficiency again within the bounds of being sporty.
Right, and I mean, like, you're not even necessarily killing them. It's like a you know, do you want to watch them have psychological panic by the fact that you almost got them or whatever?
Yeah, like, yeah, it's kind of the equivalent of like running up the score in like football or something,
which
it's
is
like
cool.
Which is very cool, and I love when teams do that. And some people are like, oh, it's boring when it's a blowout, and I'm like, sir, you are not watching this game correctly.
You do not know how football works.
Blowouts are the best part of football.
Whenever a coach apologizes for blowing out another team, I get so mad. Like, why did you? What is wrong with you?
That's loser talk. So yeah, I think I would be interested though in efficiency for the reason that I'm not confident. I would be worried that if I had a chance and I intentionally didn't take it to drag out the full 3 days, like 72 hours. Like, yes, it would be great if in the 71st hour. I you know, pulled the trigger on the paintball gun and won. You know, it's like if the prey was only 1 hour away from winning the million and I was like, aha, I've got you. That would be great. However, I'd be worried that I would miss my chance if I didn't take it earlier.
I think that's fair. Like, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's sort of like you end up kind of being in the position of, I mean, it is a little bit like a football game, right? Like where you're like, okay, How confident am I that I can bring this home? How confident am I that I can win the Super Bowl or something like that? Right? Like, think about like the way that the Niners played. Like, you know, they made some funny play calls, and they were a little cute. And it's like, okay, well, are you really that confident that you're going to coast at this point? Are you willing to do that? Are you so confident that you're willing to say, you know what, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Who cares? Like I got this team beat, or the Falcons when they lost to the Patriots that year, when the Patriots had the huge comeback. It's like, yeah, we're fine. I'm cocky now. It's great. We won this. If you as a person can get there, you're going to approach the hunt in a very different way than a person who can't get there. And
exactly.
I like, yeah, you. I'm a person that can't get there.
So I'd be looking to, so I'm leveraging the land. I am perhaps setting out a trap boat or a trap treehouse or something like that. I like that idea. I'll tell you one thing that I wouldn't be doing because I don't think I'd be good at it is tracking.
Oh, kind interesting.
Of, you know, looking for trails or like, oh, I found a campfire or whatever. I just feel like I'd be very terrible at that aspect of it.
So you would rely more on your planning to begin with, like you, not so much the idea of like, okay, we're actively hunting this person. It's more like you're more like someone who set out a nefarious plot.
Yeah, I would be relying on the fact that I stacked the odds so well in my favor ahead of time that all I have to do is see which of my various scenarios the person put himself in and then spring the trap accordingly.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. I think if anything, the person, the antagonist in the most dangerous game lost because he decided that he was part of the hunt too and was going to hunt this person. Like once you get personally involved in the hunt, that's where you start making bad decisions. It's like gambling, which is good. You know, thank you DraftKings for supporting.
It's almost time for the most dangerous game tournament, and DraftKings has you covered.
Did you see there was an SNL sketch with where it was like it was DraftKings for you could bet on when your friend would make a bet that would ruin his life. It was like you could bet on like what would happen or do parlays, like he'd lose his house and like his wife would leave him and stuff like that.
I worked with a guy years ago who he would come into work on Mondays after football games on Sunday, and he would look just like it was like a character in a book you would read. Like he would be all super hungover. He would come into work super late, and I would ask him how his Sunday was. And he would tell me, yeah, I just lost like $9,000 yesterday. It was brutal.
I mean, confidentially speaking, was he making enough money that losing $9,000 made sense, or was he making horrible choices?
He was making enough money where like he'd be okay, but like also it would be, I mean, it would not be ruinous, but it would be like really bad. Like, it's not like he wasn't making like seven figures and it's like, oh, I lost $9,000, like fiddledy fee.
He's making enough money that he can live comfortably, but that's $9,000 is still quite a lot of money.
Exactly right. Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's,
yeah, it was really upsetting.
Did he ever win?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, every now and then he would win big because he's betting these huge sums of money. And of course, like, that's how they get you. Like, you know, because then it's like, all right, well, now I've kind of come back. And so, you know, it's like, you know, they don't build casinos because the casinos lose.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's like, and I mean, this is the, of course, the, I mean, it comes back actually to the question we're doing. It's like, you know, sports betting, I think, gets a lot of people because people think they're smarter than the books. And you're just like, oh, well, this is going to be an easy one. The book, this is a dumb line. And like 1 out of 10 times you can identify a dumb line. 9 out of 10 times they have it perfectly set and you are making a horrible mistake. And so, yeah, I think that's it. Like you can read a person and say, that was such a stupid mistake. I'll get them next time. And like, this person has no hope. And you might just be wrong because like, facing off against something that is like a reasoning being is not easy.
And it's the idea, it's the fallacy that that you know better, you've got secret knowledge, and ignoring the fact that these institutions are paying, you know, dozens of super smart people to, you know, carefully set the odds, knowing that there, you know, a huge amount of money is on the line. And yeah, it's not unheard of for someone to succeed in gambling, but it's like, is it really going to be you? You know, that's kind of like thinking that you're good enough to play professional football. It's like, some people are, but they're vanishingly few, and it's probably not you.
It was like the time I won a couple hands of blackjack. It was like, maybe I could do this as a living. And then you immediately lose. Like, oh yeah, wait, no. You can't. That's unless I can count cards, this is not going to work.
You're right, though, to bring it back to the most dangerous game. You're right, I think, in the analogy that in the most dangerous game, both the story and I think the scenario that we're describing, it is a house always wins kind of setup. You know, the offer of the $1 million and the fact that the prey thinks to himself like, well, I'm a thinking, reasoning being, and it's only 3 days. Surely I can stay out of sight for 3 days. It's a big island.
It's way easier to get cocky as the hunted than the hunter, I think.
And you're not thinking about how the advantages that the house has are so stacked against you in such myriad ways. You know, I mean, just in the course of this conversation, we talked about setting things up ahead of time and having these kind of traps, psychological traps. And
full knowledge of the island, resources. You can stay well fed. You have like a mansion you're living in, or at least a house, right? Like you have a place, you have supplies.
You know, we didn't even touch on, and again, arguable if this is sporting or not, but you could plant all over the island various kind of poisonous species that perhaps someone who is not up on their flora might eat to get sustenance.
Some berries. Yeah. You're not even saying like there should be just like a bunch of copperheads going around. You can survive 3 days on Copperhead Island. I don't think I can. I don't want to do it.
The whole island is just like a thin sheet of paper over an active volcano.
Welcome to Volcano Island.
I mean, Stable Island.
I mean, definitely Safe Place Island. Yeah, it's interesting. I find it really, like, because I think that question of, like, what would you do if you were in that situation? And that's why the story is popular, is, like, thinking about that is interesting, too, because it's like, okay, yeah, what would I do? Would I go and try and, like, figure out the island? Would I try and find, like, a safe place? I mean, you can look at, like, any games like PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds or even Fortnite or whatever, where it's like, okay, you can have a strategy, right? Like, my strategy is always hiding and hoping that I last long enough. And it works a lot of the time. You find a good place to hide. No one finds you. I went to the one time in PUBG, I just laid down in a field and slowly crawled toward the safes.
That's funny because like if the question is reversed, what would I do as the prey? I mean, it would surely be some variation of that.
Gotta hide. You know, yeah. There's no other choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Try not to move.
Right. I mean, like. It's hard to imagine because a lot of times it's like, you know, people would imagine with like a slasher or something, but which I mean, and famously, if you hide from a slasher, it doesn't work. But, you know, like if you find a like a place undercover and you can sort of like find a little place and sort of like tuck in and not be like, you know, try and be as still as possible, I think you got a pretty good chance. I think you just gotta like get past your fear and stuff like that. Again, another thing the house has, but yeah, I mean, I think your answer to the question is a really good one, because it's like, it's not focusing on, oh, I'd have like a radar gun, or I'd have like, you know, I'd make sure that like my dogs could sniff them out or whatever. Like, it's more just thinking about like, okay, like, well, what am I good at, and what could I exploit? What am I not good at? In this case, tracking, and like thinking about that. I wonder, and this isn't a question either of us can answer, but I wonder how much that plays into like actual hunters as well. Like, I wonder how much hunters actually think about this. Like your dad, I wonder if he had certain skills he particularly enjoyed and certain skills he felt like he wasn't so good at.
Yeah, I know part of it for him, and I think for a lot of hunters, is they kind of fancy themselves as like, you know, behavioral experts on the animal they're hunting. And so it's the idea of being able to predict what the animal may or may not do in a situation. Like, oh, if I, you know, there's like deer calls, which I think is kind of like a basic idea. Like, I'll just trick the animal into coming over to me.
Yeah, classic.
But then I think there's like, you know, not being downwind from the deer, and certain times of day, maybe the deer is apt to be more or less risky depending on like if it's hungry. Like I think there's a, or if it's mating season, I think that's like a whole other layer on top of it. So I think there's a lot of stuff like that.
I guess like that's why people like Hannibal Lecter or something are very interesting, because you sort of think like, well, they could hunt man perfectly because they know everything about them.
Yeah. There's something really compelling about, and like a guy like Hannibal Lecter uses his powers for evil, although he did help the FBI. So who can say?
Yeah. And then most of the people he eats in those movies are not nice.
You know, you're right. I think the jury's still very much out on Hannibal Lecter.
I agree. I think maybe he's nice. Maybe he's a good person. Have we really decided this man is evil just based on what he likes to do and the ways he murders? It seems wrong.
If you get another shot at a film class, I mean, I think you could have a whole unit on Hannibal Lecter.
Just teach Manhunter through the rest. Like, was Brian Cox who plays him later? Why am I forgetting this? Famous Anthony Hopkins. Was Brian Cox or Anthony Hopkins more innately evil? Who can say?
But yeah, this idea of there could be people like Hannibal Lecter, or perhaps like the Russian industrialist or whatever he was, the whipsman.
The Nauter.
There could be these people who have such a deep grasp of human psychology that they almost have this supernatural ability to sort of, you know, like when Hannibal Lecter is telling Clarice the profile of the person she's looking for. And you know, he's also kind of getting into her past and like talking about why she feels the way she feels. It's all very interesting, the idea that someone could be on that level of human psychology.
Well, and I guess that's what makes it more interesting. I mean, it makes it more interesting and also just like a little bit more problematic to you know, hunt someone you know. Like if you were hunting me, you'd be like, well, Trevor's not very, like Trevor can like get around, but I wouldn't say Trevor's a shape. So like probably I'm not looking for him to like be deep into the island on day one. And like, I know that he likes to hide. Or like if I was hunting.
Right. I know your PUBG strategy.
Yeah, you do. So you're looking in fields, you're like getting low, you're poking things with a stick. And when I say, ow, you go, oh, I'm sorry. It's like, you're out. But like, yeah, it's or if I was hunting you, it's like the same thing. Like, I think that's what makes the stranger thing so interesting, because you essentially boil it down to, okay, this is like a person. This is like an animal. Like, this is the most dangerous game because it is literally an animal. You have no relation with it, but it's as smart as you.
Yeah. I think that was sort of the premise behind Predator too.
Yes, absolutely.
The idea that, oh, what if you're being hunted by, it's like something even smarter than man, something created to be a pure hunter, but and it's kind of like a person, you know, it's like a bipedal, you know, creature, but it's like a person who has been optimized to all they do is hunt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And like, I think, you know, again, Predator does a good job, and you know, like there are ways to like wildly overstate this. Predator does a good job of like getting to that point about hunters and thinking like, well, you know, like we're pretty okay with hunters hunting deer. And the predator's just like, he's a hunter. That's what he does. Like, it's not evil that he's hunting the humans. That's just how he is.
Right. Right. Do we fault the snake for biting? We cannot.
No, we do.
But Trevor,
bad snake. Bad snake.
We cannot. I have a snake hanging off my arm right now, and I don't fault him, and I'm not dissuading him from doing what he has been created to do.
That's so brave. The scorpion stings you, and you ask why, and it says, well, it's in my nature. And you're like, oh, that's actually pretty true. You stung me. We'll both drown. Why'd you do that? Well, I'm a scorpion. I sting things. Oh, right.
Great point. Great point, buddy.
I love the idea of the toad saying, that was a great point.
I thought that's how that story ended, that the toad was like, yeah, I mean, fair enough.
Or like the rabbit and the fox going across the fox's nose. It's like, well, all right. Well, bad news. Like, oh, yeah, you're right. You eat rabbits. My bad.
What you do is you take the rabbit and the grain across first, and then you go back with just the grain.
Wolf doesn't want the grain.
Wolf doesn't want the grain. That's the thing. The wolf doesn't. The thing is, you can make return trips. That's the secret of that riddle.
Right. Then you go back with the wolf, but you grab the rabbit when you get back with the wolf, and then you grab the grain.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a great people don't think outside the box. That's the problem.
Well, Josh, thanks for answering my cue of there are a wolf, a sheep, and some grain on the side of the bridge. You can only take one at a time.
Also, spoiler alert for that riddle. Sorry, everybody.
It would be such like, I don't look up like hardest word riddles. Let's see if I could find one. Challenging. Let's see. What is a hard riddle? 40 hard riddles with answers. My cue for you is going to be, what is there one of in every corner and two of in each room?
One of in every corner, two of in every room. What you do is you take the corner across first.
It is the letter O.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good riddle. I like that riddle.
It's like the, I don't know if you have read The Hobbit recently.
I have
the
not.
Riddles in The Hobbit. Tilly and I are listening to the audiobook periodically, and the riddles in The Hobbit are ridiculous. The one that Bilbo gets Gollum on is, what's in my pocket? Which he just blurts out, and then Bilbo then, you know, he can't tell him. He has no idea. But the riddles are like, I'm going to try and find one. And then you answered. It's fine. Here we go. 30 right horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still. I guess I can add, what are they?
So you got stamping, you got standing still.
You have 30 white horses on a red hill. The colors are important. I'll let you know that.
Right. Why would they specify?
And the number too.
Why would they specify the colors if the colors weren't important?
That's very true.
It's like superfluous data otherwise.
Could be a red herring.
Could be a red herring.
Could be a red herring.
Could be a white herring.
30 white herrings on a red hill. Josh, their teeth.
Their teeth. I don't love that riddle. I like the first one more.
How about this one?
Wait, but what? Wait, so some are stamping and some standing still?
It's like chewing.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like that.
First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still. They want food. I'm champing at the bit, and then they stamp. They stamp the food down.
Yeah, but here you go. I don't know if they stamp.
How about this one? Voiceless it cries, wingless flutters, toothless bites, mouthless mutters. What is it?
All right, so mouthless mutters is like, that's like a grandparent.
It's grandpa.
That's Grandpa Joe.
This is a flawed riddle because it also could be grandpa.
This is our tie-in actually with the new Wonka movie. And this riddle is Grandpa Joe is the answer. And you can see Wonka now in theaters with Timothy Charmaine.
Well, Josh, thank you for answering my cue and all the rest of them after that too.
Wait, what was the riddle? What was it? Grandpa Joe?
Oh, the wind.
The wind.
Well, that's the problem. It could be Grandpa Joe, right? The wingless flies is not great, but I mean, if he wants to fly, if he's senile, but no, it's the wind.
So there's a funny I was about to describe a video version of this riddle where the answer is the wind. But as we all know, describing videos is great podcast entertainment.
Everyone loves that. I'll give you one more. You seem to be really liking these. You measure my life in hours and I serve you by expiring. I'm quick when I'm thin and slow when I'm fat. The wind is my enemy.
What's the natural enemy of the wind? I mean, a bit. Is it Grandpa Joe?
Every riddle's answer is just a grandpa. Yeah, okay. My dying grandfather. He's quick when he's thin and slow when he's fat. The wind is his enemy. I measure my life in hours. He serves me by expiring. It's the great will set up for me.
See, what you do is you send the fox over with your grandpa.
Oh, it's so nice to know what the clip's going to be. The answer for anyone listening to the clip is a candle.
Oh, enemy is wind. Candles don't like wind, famously.
And you measure their life in hours. They serve you by expiring because as you light it, it sort of goes away. But it's also a grandpa. God,
this has been riddle casting with Josh and Trev.
Riddle casting would be a great show. People would absolutely listen to it.
Now ideally on riddle casting you would have someone who could occasionally get one of the riddles.
I'm sorry, riddle casting is all about pointing out how riddles are flawed because they could be about grandpas. Riddle casting is about breaking down Big Riddle.
I hate Big Riddle.
Big Riddle doesn't want you to know. Well, Josh, another lovely cue aid.
Wonderful cue. Our most creative cue. And I learned a little bit about myself and how I would,
hunt a person. Yeah, I mean, you can always ask me how. Actually, don't ask me that. It would be too scary. I feel like there are questions that are too scary. Like, how would you kill a person? I would never ask you that. But the idea of hunting a person for some reason, that did not trigger my fear sense. So.
Trevor, cue for you. How would you assassinate the president?
Josh, I'm glad you asked. First, what did the president like? Can we lure the president somewhere?